You're listening to The Gold Standard, Episode 28, Nare Sol, Reinventing the Classical, Part 2.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to The Gold Standard, the podcast of the Glenn Gould Foundation, where we present conversations with some of the world's most amazing and astonishing artists. And today, I'm delighted to say that we are going to present part two of our conversation with the amazing Nare Sol. Now, if you missed part one, please go back and check it out. It's really a remarkable conversation with a young artist who was all set to follow a more or less traditional career as a classical pianist, and she decided one day to completely reinvent her direction. Now she is a composer, and she is a YouTube sensation, bringing the wonders of classical music, the classical piano, and all the excitement and adventures of performing and of composing to an audience of over 500,000 followers. So right now we will pick up part two with the beginning of her career on public television in the United States. How did your collaboration with PBS come about? You were co-host of Soundfield, which is a really terrific program.
Thank you.
And I really love the dynamic between you and your co-host.
Arthur.
Yes, Arthur. He's fantastic. He's a percussionist in about five different genres, right? Musically speaking.
Oh, so many. He is such a multifaceted artist. And the whole team at PBS, they're great because the brainstorming sessions for different topics were always so open. And I was very happy to be a part of that project. How it came about was that they were familiar with my YouTube channel and they had general ideas of a new music show. And Arthur and I came on to help form that. We were part of the first season. He's still a co-host. I'm no longer a co-host. But when I was working with them on these episodes, it was in many ways what I was doing on my YouTube channel. But
with a big team.
Yes. And yeah, exactly. With a big team, with more resources and different ways of structuring the footage. My strategy for my videos has been and still is very improvised in terms of, hey, we're going to take a look at this topic. So here are the general bullet points of what I want to talk about and what I want to focus on. And then I grab footage just in whatever capacity I can. And then just to tie up the knots at the end, I'll have maybe a more structured talking to the camera bit where I just tie the narrative together. But it was very different for PBS, where everything is very scripted and we know what we're going to say and who we're going to interview and all of that. That was a very enlightening experience for me to work with a team.
Well, I thought it was brilliant. And again, Arthur Buckner, right? Arthur,
yes, yes.
Fabulous. And what I loved about it is the enormous respect that he showed for your music and the enormous respect that you showed for his music. And that really allowed you to cover an enormous amount of territory. By the way, when you were talking about your experience with kids and bringing music that they're not familiar with to them, next time you're in contact with PBS, we do need a new version of the Young People's Concerts that Leonard Bernstein used to do. So you should be the host for that. You get my vote.
Thank you.
I think that would be an awesome series, and I think you would be perfect to do it.
Thank you. I would love to work more with kids sometime in the future. I just love how straightforward they are and how open to many new ideas they are. They're truly like sponges.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually something that I've seen in my own life, particularly during the time when we were working very closely with El Sistema in South America. And for people who think that kids can't get into classical music or any particular kind of music, let's say jazz, you see these kids who are learning to beat time to Mozart from the time they're about 2 or 3 years old. And by the time they're 7 or 8 and they're actually picking up a fiddle and learning to play, you know, Eine kleine Nacht music, they adore it. They adore everything else too. They love rock and salsa and hip hop and so on. but they basically are completely open to it. So, you know, I think that there's room for that. Let me ask you, is there a downside to YouTube and an internet-focused career generally? The internet operates on an internal machinery that's built on algorithms, which in a sense tailors what you get recommended to you to what you've shown an interest in previously. So to a certain extent, it's more oriented towards not encouraging you to branch out into other things, but to continue with the same thing that you've already expressed a preference for. Is that something that you sometimes have to kind of work around in order to build an audience and allow people to discover your work?
Yes, definitely. And there are so many different challenges to being an internet musician in any capacity, especially if you're creating videos. Oh, this word is so loaded. Content-oriented.
Yes, content.
Content-oriented. Content. And not just uploading, let's say, performance pieces or original music. You mentioned the algorithm. The algorithm to me is more than just how a platform organizes their material like YouTube. It's just a representation on people's viewing habits. I don't think it's anything fancier than that, although there are small strategies that you can use to optimize what's under your control. But the fact is that the viewing culture of people is very fickle. They want you to be consistent to what you created when they discovered you and why they started following you. So it's this, we want more of that mentality. But at the same time, because internet culture and just people's attention spans these days is moving so fast, people are also wanting something new and different on a consistent basis. So these right. two things don't necessarily gel well together all the time. It's great to have a mixture of it because you can definitely do a bit of both, but it's hard to curate in this way. And the more you're aware of this and of people's viewing habits, the more it will be hard to break free from it. As a musician, as any creative individual, we're not always in one single mode. We're not always wanting to focus on a specific topic all the time or a specific angle all the time. We're shifting and certain things are not predictable and hard to confine to a framework. So as soon as you are aware of this and you understand that it pays off to do a video a certain way, package it in a certain way, make sure that you cover this topic consistently enough throughout the month to then say, according to my musical integrity right now, and just sticking to what genuinely interests me at this given moment, it does not align with what YouTube theoretically is asking of me.
Right.
And honestly, for me, there are some times where I say, well, I'm interested in this, so I'm going to do it anyway. And never mind if the viewership drops, but it's very hard to do and impractical to be stubborn about that all the time. Because what can easily happen is that internet momentum that you've created is going to be unstable and
it'll dissipate.
Exactly. And I think that's very, very difficult as someone that is trying to do music for music's sake and make videos for the creative aspect about it, and also be practically rooted in just the reality of this is now my job and this is how I make a living.
Right.
Therefore, I can't be too risky about certain things. So
right.
anyway, the combination yeah. of things makes it difficult. I yep. try my best to just keep it balanced so that I'm not ignoring the side of me that wants to branch out and do something very different or do something that I know there's such a limited audience for. Because if I don't feed that, I think ultimately I will become depressed quite, right, quite right, simply. Right.
Well, you don't want to stagnate creatively. I mean, it makes me wonder if you think about a composer who went through many, many different stylistic phases. Let's say Stravinsky, right? So if he had been a YouTuber and he'd had success with Petrushka and the Firebird, he would have basically committed YouTube suicide by doing the Rite of Spring. He would never have been allowed to go and do things with a jazz influence like L'Histoire du Soldat. He wouldn't have been able to go into his neoclassical phase. And he would certainly not have been allowed to do 12-tone music at the end of his life.
Right, right.
So in a way, there is a kind of a straitjacket downside. How, well, A, is getting subscribers, people who are loyal to you and will stick with you, part of the solution? And is diversifying so that you're not only on YouTube the other part of the solution?
I think subscribers are still important, but it's not hardly as important as just the number of views. I think it's best to treat a video as its own separate project, as if it was not tied to a channel with however many subscribers you have. Right. Because I just noticed that if I bank on the fact that I have a certain amount of subscribers and I'll just assume that a certain guaranteed portion of them will watch the video, I don't think that the video will actually translate and mm-hmm. be shown to people, because it just doesn't work that way. It's not a fixed thing just because people are subscribed. It's better to just view a video as its separate project. Is it interesting to me? Is it interesting to a potential viewer? And is it just a worthy enough topic, maybe on the entertaining side of things or the very educational side of things, wherever it lies on the spectrum, then it's worth pursuing the video. But I'm glad you asked this question, because it's not straightforward at all. And there are days when, honestly, I do feel very lost, simply put, at just handling all of this and trying to understand, how is this going to work long term? Because right. you put it with the best word, it's almost like a straitjacket sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that side of things makes YouTube very, very unsustainable for a lot of musicians and creative individuals, in my opinion, because right. it just demands a certain thing from you. That being said, I think if you find the right audience, there are people that go out of their way to support you and yep. make sure that you have that cushion underneath so that you don't have to rely on just the YouTube engine. And that's why platforms like Patreon, I use Patreon, where I have a group of really generous individuals that subscribe to me there, and they give me a little bit of financial support each month. And that adds up so that I use that as a living to support myself
right.
and not look at YouTube as the source of my income. Because if that were the case, I would not be able to eat.
YouTube has cut down and cut down and cut down
yes.
how much the content creators mm-hmm. Make. I hate that
no,
too.
No, no.
Content is what you stuff into a tin can before you put the label on it.
I'm really curious how that they chose and landed on the word content. But it is true. As a content creator, I cannot upload as often as the YouTube engine right. wants you to upload. And there are so many exceptions to all of these soft, not rules, but these
right.
these quirks about the internet and YouTube. But from my experience, I put out my best work and I feel the best about my work when I'm not putting out something and uploading just for the sake of consistency, just for the sake of showing up
right.
every week or every however much time.
Yeah, when you feel a real inspiration or you feel really excited by a topic, absolutely. And obviously, if this were a nobler and better world than the one we live in, that would be enough all by itself, and you would never be pressed to compromise and move in a direction other than what you honestly, legitimately feel most right. drawn to.
There are pros and cons to all of it. Those are the cons, but I'm able to actually have a career and do what I love because I'm able to upload things onto YouTube and put my voice out there and put my work out there.
Exactly. And Bach had to write a new cantata every single week for like 5 years in Leipzig. the job of doing the job of making music is also part of being a professional in the field.
Absolutely.
Do you have a sense of what your audience breakdown is like, whether it's because of comments you get, like age, demographic, geographic spread, whether they're diehard classical people or converts or newbies, or who are the people who are your listeners?
I do have a general sense based on what the analytical reports show me from places like YouTube and Instagram as well. But it's very hard to know for sure. And I think I get more information from comments and emails and different polls that I've put out. But the general demographic, I would say, is people between the ages 20 and 35, mostly in North America, but different parts of Central Europe, some Asia as well, Latin America. Mm. And in terms of their relationship to music, most are, I would say, not diehard classical fans.
Oh, good.
They're classical music appreciators. And they are a small portion are professional musicians and aspiring musicians, music students. I think the vast majority are people that work in completely different fields, but they are passionate enough about music as a whole, maybe not tied to a specific genre even, although I see a lot of jazz, and I would say jazz is maybe the biggest tick mark that I see of favorite genres. And then there's the people that love rock, fusion, and any of the genres that I've covered in my videos, you know, bossa nova, yeah, flamenco, hip hop, beats. Although I never actually covered hip hop formally. But anyway, you get the point.
Yeah.
It's a mixed bag. And I find that interesting because I do put out certain material that is very narrowed into the classical music, especially pianist oriented videos. And yet people still watch the video. So I think it's very interesting that there's something there for everybody, I guess.
Yeah, I think that those are fascinating, even for non-pianists. And that was something that I was really curious about myself, because it's the kind of thing that someone who is, let's say, we put it in the Canadian context, let's say, doing grade 10 piano at the Royal Conservatory and thinking, you know, do I want to keep doing this? Do I want to go for my performance diploma? How can I deal with this particular technical issue that I always hang up on, or memorization, or, you know, how does someone who's, you know, been through it handle that? And it's really interesting to see that it isn't just those, you know, young artists who are watching those. There are people who are just curious, like, how is this done? How does someone who actually sits down and plays this challenging music, this hard to perform music, this lightning fast finger music, deal with the technical issues of, well, I think you had one on how to make your trills more expressive, right? You know, that's pretty specific, for pianists, but you got a lot of listeners.
I just imagine one individual subscriber from time to time and how they might react to how I hop around different topics and how I zoom in and out of how detailed I'm going. And so how jarring that may be for some people. But I think it just works because at the end of the day, I really don't know. And I can't put my finger on exactly the type of viewer that I have, because there are many, and you just have to accept the fact that sometimes a certain topic will not resonate with a viewer, but that same topic may be filling in a void that is very, very needed for a group of musicians or a group of viewers out there, and that it means something to me, so I will make the video. So you can't always please everybody, but
you please a lot of people, so, you know, the track record's pretty good. Hey, your first album, Alice in Wonderland, was released last year, and I love the music. It's typically Nara-ish in its eclecticism. It includes a track with piano and electronics. It has another with prepared piano. Some of it is very highly charged, frenetic, energetic music. Some of it has that kind of a tranquility that, you know, I associate with Satie. Although in Satie's case, I always think that he wants you to think it's tranquility, but it's really indifference.
That's a great way to put it.
Well, he was a bit of a joker. You know, he was part of that whole Dadaist thing. Tell us a little bit about how that recording evolved, where it got started, and what some of your future plans are.
I was wanting to put together an album for a very long time prior to that project. There's a certain discipline that's required to curate something from start to finish and decide, most importantly, what are you going to put in an album that you're attaching your name to and you're curating in a way that there's a theme or not? And why would you put these pieces together and put it out there to represent yourself? And for me, I knew I wanted to do something like that in order to organize some things, I guess, for lack of a better word, in my head about my own compositional voice. Everything from trying to define it, trying to understand more of it, and trying to organize a chapter of my life, because I'm constantly, as any other composer out there is, evolving and changing. And that process was almost like a practice of making sure that I'm sure about my own voice and elements of it and deciding how to represent that. So that being said, all of the pieces on there are pieces that I was writing leading up to that year. And I never had time nor the will to sit down and finalize. I would perform these pieces, some of these pieces I was performing, yet I never really drafted up my final version of it or had it polished in a way. And that was largely due to the fact that I was dedicating a lot of time to YouTube and making videos. And I felt that, like, the conveyor belt effect, where I just thought, yeah, I need to continue this. And so saying that I'm going to make an album and focus on that gave me a reason and a structure to carve out time that was just empty time, basically, to gather my thoughts and focus in order to finish these pieces and record them. And I ended up producing and engineering most of the album as well. So it just became a big project. And while doing so, I took some time off from making videos. And it was a celebration of the piano and the part of me that really loves keyboards and loves pianism. And also, it was combining all the things that I showed on my YouTube channel, being inspired by so many different genres and styles. And so it's a mixed bag, but it's best representing of the, let's say, 3 to 4 years leading up to me recording it.
Well, it's beautiful. And some of the pieces started in improvisation, didn't they? Like,
yes.
Salad, I remember seeing an improvised version, which you put to visuals of yourself making a salad.
Absolutely.
And actually, it's something that you've been very eloquent about, which is the need for classical music to reclaim its improvising heritage.
Yes. And there are many artists out there that, especially with the use of electronics as well and different contemporary techniques, many people are embracing improvisation. I think there's room for more of that. And I love talking about that and sharing things about that on my channel. And I like it as a personal form of growth and challenge for me as well, because I come from a place where at first I was not comfortable with improvisation. But tracks like Salad Music, I made footage of me tossing a salad, and it was a sort of an analogy for putting together different little elements in the music and mixing them together and finding pitches that work together. Maybe it's in a certain mode or a certain sound. And just by combining different pitches, you can get something that sounds different or similar. And so I did expand on that for the album.
it is interesting because for people who think that jazz is the only place where improvisation, I mean, you know, Mozart improvised, Beethoven improvised. If you go back a couple hundred years before them in the early music world, they improvised a lot on instruments like the lute. Baroque composers improvised ornaments a lot. Bach improvised whole pieces. So now you have this album. It's a great album. I think everyone should go out and listen to it. I highly recommend it. Do you have your sights set on other realms, orchestral music, chamber music, film scoring, opera even?
Yes, in fact, all of those things. I am working on putting together another album, which is delayed because of the pandemic and everything. But I would like to explore a little more with synthesizers, which I really love, and
yeah,
expanded orchestration, everything from small ensembles to maybe even a chamber orchestra. And in the last 2 years, I've been writing more and more for instrumentation that is not just keyboard or solo piano. In fact, more pieces that are not for that than just piano. I wrote a piece for piano and chamber orchestra that I'll perform in Manitoba in a few months. I'm working with a vocalist, writing text and looking for text. I did a little bit of film scoring as well earlier this last year and was graciously granted an opportunity to write for a cue in Boss Baby 2. It's an animated movie, and I worked with Hans Zimmer and his team and Steve Massaro, and I wrote a piece for full orchestra and many other soloists for that. So that was very exciting and very different. And yes, I hope to put out more music formally in the coming future that represents this side of my compositions.
Well, we will be listening with great interest. And I saw the videos about your work with the Manitoba Chamber Orchestra, which was that one commission piece?
It was actually several, because the original dates for the performance of the piece for piano and chamber orchestra, that was postponed due to lockdown and everything. So they had a great remote virtual program set up. And so they commissioned some solo pieces and also a piece for piano violin, which is about to be premiered. So that is very exciting.
That is fantastic. That's great. Well, we'll listen with interest for that as well. Let's talk a little bit about music and mental health to make a pretty big shift. I think you know it's a subject that's very near and dear to our hearts here at the Glenn Gould Foundation, since we recently launched the Instrumental Project, which is aimed at teens and helping them to reap the benefits of being more deeply engaged with music in terms of their own inner well-being. Now you're in a kind of a self-directed musical career, and it's one that doesn't have a well-established playbook to guide you. You've talked about how being a musician in today's world also means you have to be your own manager, your own mini media company. You have to be your own promotion company. That's a much more anxiety-ridden and precarious and frankly stressful way to live as a musician. How do you cope with those aspects of your career and the changing face of the industry? And while you're making a living from your music, are you still able to turn to it and find peace of mind and comfort and joy and a sense of healing when times are getting tough and stressful?
Mm-hmm. I do find a lot of comfort, a lot of joy in just sitting at a piano and making music. And I would say I've worked hard at protecting that part of things from experience, because I've had times where I completely let the work side of things override my just pure inspiration for making music and everything. And that really was soul crushing. And I just very simply observed the decline of my mental health, the decline of my mood, my will to do things, and just my liveliness in general when I let that happen. And I just realized that even though music and that side of music is something that I just so adore and love, that space is not going to be protected automatically. I have to actively manage it so that I make sure that I have a certain time and space throughout the day or throughout the week or wherever I can fit it in. Because if you just let things happen by chance, then things like deadlines and pressing urgent pieces in the schedule will always take over. And
right, for sure.
And your passions and your emotional needs, all that, they don't have deadlines and they don't have time frames. They're not put in the agenda. So I just learned it the hard way over the years that I need to manage myself so that, you know, I do it in different ways. I remind myself by scheduling things and I check in with myself. I talked about it recently in a video. You have to kind of separate yourself so that there's a part of you that shows up as a musician, as any creative person. And then there's a part of you that is overseeing everything and just making sure, okay, are you taking care of the deadlines and the projects so that you're not overwhelmed? And are you leaving room so that you're taking care of yourself and your passions and your interests and whatever else that needs to be taken care of? A lot of it has to do with time management and making sure that you are investing in the little annoying tasks right away so that later on, you're not going to have to pay for things that are just piled up. And I just think it's overseeing a lot of different details. And it's easy to get overwhelmed just by living today in 2022. True. Doesn't matter if you're a musician, if you have a desk job, an athlete, whatever you're doing, it's so easy to be overwhelmed. Any field comes attached with so many extras that you have to learn and you kind of have to comply to, and things are changing. Everything from the way we work, never mind the pandemic, technology is moving really fast and people's interests and what is being demanded of us as musicians or whatever field is always changing. I am very overwhelmed by that every season because despite my efforts, and I talked about how I try to manage everything, and I do give myself credit for coming to a place where I won't fall apart, or at least I haven't so far. But every season, I do come to a point where I feel not just the burnout, but this dark space where I start to question, okay, things are going, and I am taking care of things. But there's something that I can't quite put my finger on why I feel this sense of gloom and just this cloud over me. And I think it's normal. It could be seasonal, literally, or it could just be a product of compounding exhaustion.
Yep.
But I am very aware of that. And I see that being consistent amongst pretty much all of my friends, especially musician friends.
I think there's an anxiety. You have gone through previous season. So you've basically climbed Mount Everest and now it's a new season and you're right at the bottom of the mountain all over again. Mm-hmm. And you're wondering how are you going to, except that part of the rules, if you're a musician, is when you climb it, you have to climb it with a different route. You have to take a different path because you can't repeat yourself. And that can be very stress producing for sure. I mean, it's easy to say, hard to do. Part of it is just saying, okay, I feel really crappy about this, but I'm just going to throw myself onto the mountain and up we go. I can speak from personal experience, having had a record company, that when you have to think of it as the thing that you earn your living from, there's a risk that it's going to change your relationship to music. Yes. In my case, it was rather than I did this because of the sheer joy that I always experienced and how precious the music was to me, it then becomes, oh, that's really good. How much of this can we sell? And that's a very tough change. I think you really have to be able to build some really powerful compartments and separate these pieces so that one doesn't ruin the other.
Definitely. Definitely. You put it so nicely. And I would say it's just a constant learning curve. Mm-hmm. You have to figure it out as you go. And as I'm continuing on, I'm very aware of the ups and downs of it all emotionally and spiritually too. Yep. And what I find is very helpful is that on days where I am overwhelmed by everything and or I feel a lack of inspiration because this has become my work and there's something very dry about that, I start to pull back and I pay attention to things that maybe it sounds cliche, but I'm just very grateful for. And they're not big, they are big things, but I try to focus on every little detail and things that maybe are to me so obvious now. Like I was talking to my friend the other day and I was talking about, you know, isn't it amazing that the piano exists? Like we were born after the piano was invented, you know?
Absolutely.
I didn't have control over that. And the fact that these pianos are still being made and I could put it in a room where it supports the weight of the piano and things like, I appreciate great plumbing in the apartment, you know?
Yes.
What would happen if I don't have water or, you know?
Absolutely. Let's face it. You go back 120 years, mm-hmm. even 100 years, and there are lots of people in lots of cities in North America and Europe who did not have plumbing.
Mm-hmm. I remember I was with my brother a few days ago, and I was on the verge of complaining to him about something that I just was really annoyed about. It's just so on the brink of saying it. And then I just thought, I feel very uncomfortable because I'm comparing this experience to my most happiest and peaceful and comfortable situation. But if I try to imagine the alternative that is the worst of the worst, then I'll take this any day.
So exactly. Yes.
It's just a matter of rewiring certain things, but there's a lot of maintenance. I will say this to you and say it out loud and be aware of it in this moment, but it doesn't take much for me to forget about this and then get into a place where I just am just overwhelmed by the fact that I have to walk over to the piano, you know, little things.
Right.
It's so irrational. And I think it's just part of being human. We have to just rewire and remind ourselves and parts of ourselves that there are other ways to think about this that will prevent you from wanting to self-implode.
I've noticed that there are certain recurring elements that, you know, make repeat appearances in your videos. Happy birthday is one. For Elise is another, the piece that you love to hate. Your adorable dogs, occasionally your lovely mother is another. But Glenn Gould is in there too. He makes an appearance every now and then.
Yes.
And since this is his 90th birthday year, let's talk a little bit about him. What fascinates you? I mean, you went to the Glenn Gould School, so presumably you got a fair exposure to Gould and his legacy. But, you know, what is it about him that you think makes him an interesting musical figure to this day?
I admire, first and foremost, just simply his playing and how transported I am when he's playing and when I hear his recordings. And I'm not thinking about the interpretation or the pianist, even though it's so specifically Glenn Gould. I'm hearing the music as if he's creating it together with the composer. And I think that's very unique and very hard to do as a pianist playing someone else's work, to be so fixed into the actual work, because his interpretation is almost compositional.
Yes.
Yet keep the integrity of the composer. And many purists might say that his Bach interpretations are a bit extreme or not ideal. But for me, it is, because when he plays it, he convinces me with his sense of timing, with his articulation and everything behind the music, that I'm convinced, and that's all that matters. Another thing that I really admire about Glenn Gould is that he pioneered the art of recording and the art of technology related to the performing artist, especially as a classical musician.
Let's do a little quick pop quiz, and we can wrap up on that.
Pop quiz,
yes. Okay, so the 5 or 6 really fast questions. Okay, your dream piano?
A Steinway B.
A B? Oh, a little guy.
Yes.
Okay, Steinway B. All right, folks, Patreon fans, you know what you got to get for Nare. Okay, Goldberg versus Diabelli variations?
Goldberg.
Goldberg. Okay. Hardest piece to play?
Ooh, put me on the spot there.
Yeah.
Messiaen van Regard, maybe?
Okay. Yeah, Messiaen. Oh, interesting. I figured it'd be something French, but I thought you might go for Gaspar. Yeah.
Oh, Gaspar. Gaspar is up there too.
Yeah. Okay.
Or Alcon.
Alcon. Oh.
Anything
oh, you
Alcon.
Play Alcon. Wow.
No, I don't play Alcon. I just know that Alcon is very difficult.
Fingerbender.
You know, okay, even though you asked me one piece, I would add 2 etudes there. Chopin's Opus 10, number 2, and Liszt's Faux Follets. I would say those two are fiendishly difficult.
Right. Okay. Ultimate piano composer, Chopin or Liszt?
Chopin.
Okay. Impressionism or German Romanticism?
Impressionism.
Ah, excellent. Okay. And finally, the movie that you wish you had scored.
Ooh. Can I say a movie?
Sure. And
I'll explain why. A movie by Studio Ghibli.
Oh, wow.
I have been doing a deep dive on Studio Ghibli movies, and I absolutely adore them. The more I look into
Howl's Moving Castle, Swept Away.
I just really adore that style of animation and the whole team's vision and the storylines involved. And I'm a big fan of Joe Hisaishi. So I would say a Studio Ghibli film.
Okay, there you go, Studio Ghibli. You've got an offer right here. You heard it. You heard it here first. All right. Thank you so much. It's been great to speak with you today.
Thank you.
I feel like if Glenn Gould were around today, he would have said, this is a kindred spirit, someone who basically decided not to become a concert pianist, but explored technology as a way of unlocking her creativity and finding new and more intimate ways of communicating with an audience. And I hope that you will keep on doing that and be really exploring your inner creativity for a wide and growing audience, putting the way for new generations of classical musicians, and helping bring that music to a broader audience around the world. So thank you again, Nare. It's been fantastic to have you.
Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate it.
And friends, that brings us to the end of our conversation with the amazing Nare Sol. I really enjoyed it. It really does my heart good to talk with an artist who, on the one hand, has so much respect for tradition and is really part of tradition, but who is extending the tradition in so many exciting and imaginative new ways, using technology, using her own creativity, and in the process is bringing a completely new audience to this music. I also really appreciated her appreciation for the legacy of Glenn Gould and Rudrapriya. That should remind us all that this is Glenn Gould's 90th birthday year. We are celebrating Glenn Gould at 90, and some of our podcasts through the year will pay tribute to his legacy. Now, would you like to share some additional information about the Glenn Gould Foundation and our work with our friends?
Absolutely. If you're interested in keeping up with the Gould Standard podcast and more work from the foundation, be sure to follow us across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at the Glenn Gould Foundation. And as you know, the Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to continue bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca.
And thank you again. Please join us for our next episode of the Gould Standard. I can't tell you what it's going to be. It's going to be a surprise. But whatever it is, it's going to be absolutely marvelous. So don't miss it. Thank you. Bye-bye.